League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now. And support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to CEO Steve McQuillan and CFO Stephen King of Avingtrans, a leading supplier of niche products and services to the energy, nuclear, defence, industrial and healthcare sectors. So welcome, gents.
Hi, Paul. Good to see you again.
Hi, Paul.
Yeah, well, big congrats on this morning's inline full year 2024 results and positive outlook, with sales increasing 17% to a record £136 million. But before we sort of run through the details there, Steve, I don't suppose you could just quickly remind the audience what the company does and also its successful pinpoint invest exit strategy.
Yeah. So happy to do that, Paul. So as you highlighted there, we're an engineering business. We like to stick to regulated markets, so things like nuclear defence, medical, etc. And that helps us to maximise the results from our PIE strategy, as you mentioned it. And that has three prongs. That's a pinpoint, where we look for businesses that are typically underperforming in those sorts of marketplaces. And bolt-ons for existing businesses. So that's a sort of pinpoint part of what we do. And we did that successfully last year, as we'll come to, I'm sure, a bit later. And then we invest in them. We invest in the people. We invest in the facilities and the equipment. We invest in technology, IP. And then we also invest in routes to market. So that's typically investment phase of the game. And then eventually that, of course, leads to a much better business performance. And then we exit. And the point of that is obviously two or threefold. One, to return funds somehow or other to investors. Secondly, to enable us to invest further in research and development and new products for the rest of the group. And thirdly, of course, it gives us the cash to recycle and go back to start again and go for P again to invest in a quite new acquisition. So it's a fairly simple game, but it seems to work quite well.
You're too modest there, Steve. But over the last, it's obviously been very successful for you guys for the last sort of 15, 20 years. But typically, what's your sort of holding period and your money return on sort of like those investments?
Well, let me do the first part and let Steve do the second part. In terms of hold period, we're not a PE company, so we don't have a clock. We can hold something as long as we like. And when we built up, we did a buy and build in aerospace a number of years ago, and we held that in total for about 10 years whilst we put all the pieces of the jigsaw together. Equally, at the bottom end, about the fastest we can exit, which is what we did with Peter Brotherhood, which we might come back to as well, was about 3.5 years. So 3 years ish is about as little time as we could hold something as possible. And as I say, at the other end, it's about maximising returns for all the stakeholders and shareholders, so we can hold it ad infinitum if we want to, but typically it's, you know, 5 to 7 years would be the typical hold time. Steve, do you want to comment on the results of exits?
Well, I mean, I think the past three major exits have been between 3 and 4 times investment. obviously depends on how long we hold them for. As Steve just mentioned, typically you can't hold something for less than 3 years because people think it's a flash in the pan once you've done a turnaround. So you've got to have a couple of years of history there and obviously a good order book, etc. But typically we're looking for businesses that, well, as soon as we buy a business, should I say, we're looking for someone we can sell it to. In fact, even during the due diligence to buy a business, we're looking for people saying, okay, as Steve would say previously, we don't get into a lobster pot that you can't get out of. So yeah, doesn't always work out, and we have to keep things longer, or we can see some more diversification or other additional add-ons. But then typically we're trying to get at least double the money for our investors, and in the past 3 or 4 disposals we've been looking at 3 or 4 times. So that's the sort of money we're looking at. And then of course, as Steve says, start again.
Yeah, well, certainly over the last 15 years, your share price has gone up by about 20% per annum, which, if you sort of mean, is like double your share stock price every 4 years. So, if you, that's sort of like following the money, I think the shareholders have. Now, Steve, Em, in terms of the engineering division, which has really been the sort of the core of the company for such a long time, you've consolidated all the divisions together. What's the sort of rationale for that? Is that part of the pie strategy or?
Yes, so there are two principal reasons for that, Paul. One was to give shareholders complete clarity over the mature engineering businesses and how they are performing versus our more startup or early stage medical imaging businesses. So it gives the best possible contrast to that. But the other reason for doing that was to really get the best team possible into exits now, because we're going to be coming up to an exit phase for two or three of the businesses over the next 12 to 18 months. And so therefore, we wanted to make sure we've aligned all the jigsaw pieces in the best possible way for those exits. And that's worked well for us already. And we are now well aligned, and we'll come back to that, I'm sure, in terms of how the businesses are doing. But some of those businesses are now mature and ready to get on the runway and be exited.
Right. Well, that's a perfect segue then to move to Stephen. Steve K, if you can talk through the financial highlights for the full year, and particularly in terms of the growth and the different divisions, the margins, and the split with that aftermarket and the cash generation. Because I know the two big divisions have got different sort of like the different places, aren't they, in their cycle?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, Paul, it's nice to be able to say actually we're ahead of the upgraded market expectations when we did them in June. So, at profit level, and debt was around about the same level we expected, but you would expect that post year end. So revenue, as you say, was up 20 million, 20.2 million. Although some of that, and I'm going to try to bring us back to like for like, so comparing with the prior year. So if we extracted the Slack and Par 10 million, you still got 10 million of increase, which underlying in the AES division was up 9%. Medical was fairly flat, but then we expected medical to be fairly flat as we move into from the development phase into the revenue generation phase. And then margins slipped slightly if you look at it at a global level, so from 32.9 to 32.5%, 32.2%, should I say. Part of that is from the acquisitions, and part of that is because we've actually generated more OE work than aftermarket work. And if you look at the OE AM split, it's dropped down about a percentage overall across. However, that's still plus 6 million on the prior year. That's
Aftermarket.
just on aftermarket. So both have increased, but OE's just bounced back a little bit stronger. And then when we drop down to sort of EBITDA and EBITDA margins, we've got 14 million, base the 13.7. But of course, again, like for like, we've actually made a small profit in Slack and Par EBITDA, which was really positive because we were pushing for EBITDA break even this time last year. And Adaptix came in slightly better than its EBITDA loss. But all in all, it's about 16 million like for like the 13.7 million year before. So up really strongly. And the EBITDA percentage margins, AES was something like 13.3, including Slack and Par. But then when you, if you actually reverse that out, it was about 13.6% EBITDA margin overall. the 13.7 in the prior year. So pretty consistent, despite actually doing a bit more at OE. So we're really pleased with that. And then you drop down to something like PBT. And actually, it looks like we've dropped down quite considerably at PBT from 9 to 7.3 million. But again, on a like-for-like basis, it's nearly 12 million. So with Slack and Par, it's roughly PBT break-even. But Adaptix is about 4 million. So if you add all that back in, it's nearly 12 million. So nearly 33% increase underlying year-on-year, which shows the strength of the AES division underlying. And why we want to invest in the medical division, and I'm sure we're going to come to that in a little while. All right.
Yeah. So is basically the story is that the engineering business did really well last year. I mean, looking at your adjusted EBITDA for your engineering, it's from 15.5 million up to 17.9 million, and therefore the top level EBITDA was masked really by the investment you'd made into medical, which was obviously the loss. Is that the sort of correct analysis there, Steve?
Yeah,
I think that's a perfect analysis, Paul. That's what I was trying to say, but obviously not good enough.
And with the cash, obviously you know you've done M&A. There was a slight working capital build. Could you talk through that? I guess that's partly because of Slack and Par, because you've integrated those guys.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there was a significant increase in working cap. Yeah. Now, turnover increased 20 million, and as a rough measure, I would always put 25-26% through on the increase in turnover. So if you've got 20 million increase in working cap, you're talking about 5 million, sorry, 20 million in increase in revenue, you're talking about 5 million increase in working cap. But then on top of that, Paul, you talk about a couple of the businesses were in trouble, in distress. So Slack and Par came out of administration, and Adaptix was struggling when we took it over as well. So that's a further 2 million investment in working cap. If you look at days of sales, I think one of the analysts would look at days of sales in working cap. I think there's a couple of days increase on 26 to 28 or something along those lines. So it's a marginal increase in there. But it's a measure of success, unfortunately, that working cap goes up. We work really hard on getting advanced payments, etc. But it's a natural increase on turnover. And on top of that, Paul, you also talked about the investment. Of course, we've been invested heavily in the medical business, as you know. And that's not just in development costs of the X-ray scanners, the medical MRI scanners as well. We've had a very invested in that, but also in next generation nuclear pumps over in HT Inc. We put a couple of million into the new sodium pumps, for example, for the work we're doing with TerraPower, etc. So that's a really important thing to highlight, that it's not just medical we're investing in. We're still investing heavily in AES, and that's what's driving the results.
Good. Okay, well, let's move to the sort of top line, the demand picture then for the engineering division, Steve. I mean, I did notice actually, at the end of last week, Microsoft announced that it was partnering with Constellation Energy into reviving the Three Mile Island nuclear facility. And in the States, they've never actually restarted a facility after it's been shut down. Yeah. And they're trying to do that because there's an urgent need for clean, reliable energy to power its data centers, and this is obviously a renaissance for all nuclear. Can you just talk, because this is obviously a big sector for you guys, along with many others, but can you just talk through how you're seeing the whole sort of landscape for your niche products and services?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we are supplying things into from various different businesses in the group into those sorts of applications, Paul. As you say, nuclear is the biggest one for us, and you know everybody's back on the nuclear bandwagon now, more or less. Because they realise that they've got to have big baseload power, and you're not going to get all of it from solar and wind. So and especially when the sun doesn't shine or the wind doesn't blow, then you need something else. And nuclear is really the only way of doing it if you don't want a load of carbon-intensive energy production through oil and gas or coal or whatever. So we're certainly seeing loads of interest in extending the life of existing power plants, even in restarting them. Amazingly in America. And that's good news for us because we've got the capability to not only service our own equipment, but other people's similar equipment as well. So we get a lot of business in aftermarket from refurbishing things and upgrading them or whatever. So that's been very good news for us, particularly for Hayward Tyler, but some of the other businesses also. There's also a lot of work going on in new nuclear, so small modular reactors. Steve mentioned TerraPower, which is Bill Gates's business, working on a next generation nuclear reactor. So they're one of the principal SMR companies we're working with, but we are working with others as well. And of course, there's been a lot of press about Rolls-Royce and what they're planning to do, although I would say it's going to be a long time before Rolls get any of their SMRs on the bus bars, because they're just at the very start of their journey. So, but that's going to be interesting for later. And then we've also got a lot of work going on in fusion, both for the ITER project in France for the prototype fusion reactor, but also a number of private businesses working on fusion technology, which we are supplying technology into. So all in all, nuclear, including new nuclear, is a good game for us. And of course, another good game for us is the decommissioning, the other end, when they come out at the end of life. Mm. As you know, we're doing a load of work for Sellafield on containing waste containment. And now with NRS, which used to be called Magnox, we're doing stuff for them on waste containment. So the whole nuclear cycle is very good news for us.
Just on nuclear, I mean, also there must be really high barriers to entry, because not only do the West not want sort of like potentially hostile countries supplying them parts and services, and perhaps put China and Russia in there, but certainly China wouldn't be putting those in the facility. But also, it must be really quite difficult for new entrants hiring nuclear engineers, because frankly, there just aren't enough of them, and so you guys must have your fair share.
Yeah, and I mean, the same's true in defence, Paul. It's the same sort of rationale is happening there. And that's why we like these regulated markets, because the barriers to entry are pretty high, and nuclear is probably the highest because of all the accreditations and stamps and all the rest of it you need to be able to operate and make products there, and all the traceability that goes back years and years in terms of what you've done, who made the product, how were they trained, how was the equipment calibrated, how did you document it, what's the quality system, all sorts of stuff. And that's why we like those markets, because if we pick up a business in distress in those sorts of markets, we've got time to fix it. You know, so if we go to Sellafield and say we're buying one of your suppliers, they don't go, well, they're rubbish, we're getting rid of them. They haven't got enough good suppliers. So if we rock up and tell them we're going to fix something, they're quite happy to believe that and quite happy to support us in doing so. And the same applies in defence and other markets as well. So that's why we like those markets.
Yeah, and the pipeline and the order book must be pretty healthy then in that case, looking forward for the rest of this year, I guess, in the engineering.
Yeah, Steve will comment on the order book in total, but the pipeline and the prospects are very good, actually, across all of the businesses. So nobody's got a particularly weak pipeline. Almost all the businesses, in fact, have got a very strong pipeline. Mm. You know, both on security, high security doors, blast-proof doors, they've got the best pipeline they've ever had, I think. And Ormandy's got the best pipeline it's ever had on heat and ventilation, air conditioning as well. And I think HT's pipeline is also more or less record, Steve, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's been a strong start to the year on orders, Paul. But underlying that, going into the year, Steve mentioned, there was a really good record order book in many of the subsids. Looking back, Sellafield over at Metalcraft's over 60, 68 million, and we started at 70 million because you get this inflation uplift every year. Similarly, HS2, I think, is about 36, 38 million. And I think that's the number we first started with. That's despite us actually delivering quite a lot of stuff in the year. They just add bits and pieces, and there's lots of new further pieces to add. And as Steve said, in the nuclear market, there's very strong orders, in particular over in America, for the new engineering, what we call FEED services, which is working with businesses to develop those next generation nuclear pumps and motors, etc.
And have you got enough supply? I'm sorry, you know, enough capacity to meet the demand there on the engineering?
Much. I mean, if it keeps growing at a pace, we reach a point where you get blockages. But, you know, we try and deal with that in various ways. And in particular, you'll be aware that one of the things we do is we train a lot of our own people. We're very hot on apprenticeships. Yeah. And so we, in each business that we buy, if they haven't already got a good apprentice scheme running, we install one. Because very often in engineering businesses, the demographics aren't very good. And we've got too many folks that are grey-haired like Steve and I. Not enough youngsters. So it's a key thing for us to do over the first few years in any business to get more apprentices in and train them up so that our demographics shift to a more balanced and sustainable position. And similarly for engineers, you know, graduate engineers, but particularly apprentices for a lot of our businesses are where the focus is, to make sure we've got the right folks to take the business forward.
Well, it must be a cracking career, that, actually. There's good prospects. Now, Steve Kay, just in terms of the Slack and Par acquisition, can you just talk us through how we are on the integration? Because obviously you've done a lot of the heavy lifting if it's now profitable by the time, sure, you know, it comes to the end of the year.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, Slack and Par we purchased blimey, about this time last year actually, Paul. I think it was in end of August. So I mean it's been integrated quite well. Still work to do there, Paul. You know, obviously we want to expand aftermarket, etc. And only this month we are setting up a facility in India to do this quick turnaround aftermarket. You know, we've just successfully done that in China and in America where we've got this quick turnaround stuff. And when you've got a pump down, it's typically about getting the stuff back as quickly as possible. And if you can beat your competitor by 5 to 10 days, then typically price isn't always the key thing. But underlying, it's had pretty reasonable orders. The workforce have been secured, which is good. One or two new pump opportunities that they're developing as well, so that's quite nice to see. And I think we've now got the supply chain back under control. Obviously, as I mentioned earlier, we had to sink some working capital into that, and the quality is as good as ever. So, you know, another successful acquisition at the moment, but we've still got more to do. You know, it's still 2 more years at least before we can look at the exit side of that, and you know, maybe there's a another acquisition on top of that to supplement Slack and Par.
Yeah, okay. And then can you just say a few things? I know Steve M just mentioned it in terms of the, value creation opportunities potentially for the next 12 to 18 months. What sort of scale are we talking about in terms of sort of potential size? Are we talking single digit, double digits type of disposals if they did actually happen?
Well, I mean, it's whatever people want to pay, Paul. Everything's available for sale, including my old office was for sold. But there you go. That's just a point with myself and Mr. McHugh. I mean, if you look at the key ones, and then we've already spoken about them. I mean, you've got
Boom.
HT Group was bought 7 years ago. Okay, we had 2 years of COVID, so that's coming to maturity. And as we've just spoken about, it's going great guns. But a lot of opportunity there. We've got Ormandy, who had secured the acquisition of HVAC nearly 18 months 2 years ago. Again, that's made a real big difference. Record order book. And then you've got Booth, which again has got a really strong order book and lots of opportunities. But in particular, in Booth's case, you know, the aftermarket, as I like to say, someone's got to oil those doors. But the aftermarket is growing really strongly there, and we can see a further strong growth. We just got some more work with the QE line. We're just doing some work with Manchester Airport. So the guys then the aftermarket there are doing really really great guns, and we can see that that could probably increase to probably over 4 or 5 million, which is a significant amount of not just revenue but profit. So yeah, what could they buy? Well, if you do a multiple of 10 times on minimum of 10 times EBITDA on that, you've got a valuation.
Well,
That would be
Steve,
thereabouts.
another way to look at it is what we paid for it, isn't it? So we paid 30 million for HT, and we've been typically looking to get more than 3x out of it. So if we can't get 90 million for investors out of that, we'd be really disappointed. And hopefully we'll do better than that. But that'd be our kind of absolute minimum number, really, Paul would be looking for there. Ormandy's slightly different because we bought it from administration and put a small bolt on into it. So we only paid 1 million for Ormandy. And we're certainly looking to get a lot more than 3 million for it. It's got to be in double digits, Ormandy. You're in double digit territory for Ormandy. But exactly where, well, let's wait and see. And Booth, as Steve says, we could be even bigger than Ormandy, but we're probably going to keep investing in Booth for a while now. That's more likely now with Booth than we put it straight on the runway. So yeah, the most likely to come up for the runway are Ormandy and HT next.
Well, if you sell HT for 90 mil, you've got 33 million shares, or just over 33 million. That's even I can do the math. That's not far off a £3 a share. So plenty of
We
opportunity.
do need to reinvest a little bit more there. So, you know, it's.
I'll take your word for that. Right. Okay. Let's move to the healthcare sector. Really exciting progress over the last 12 months. In fact, as everybody happens, accidents do happen. My daughter, unfortunately, was riding a bike at the end of the weekend. She fell off it, injured her arm, had to go and spend 6 hours in A&E waiting for an X-ray. There wasn't the hospital staff there, but they didn't have the equipment either. And obviously, your Adaptic small form, helium free, lightweight X-rays and MRIs are on the cusp of hopefully helping patients like my daughter get care that they need, and to relieve some of the resources held up in hospital. So, Steve M, can you take us through where we are in terms of the commercialization strategy of this really exciting pipeline of medical imaging devices?
Yeah, indeed, and as you and other commentators have said, Paul, it's in the share price for nothing at the moment, so we've got to be able to do better than that. But it's as you said, so Adaptix is 3D X-ray. As some people have called it now, poor man's CT. So like a CT scanner gives you a kind of 3D scan through a wrist or an elbow or whatever. Adaptix can do that with an X-ray technology and do it very effectively and get really excellent images out of it. And everybody, all the customers are wowed by what they're seeing on the imaging front already there. And Adaptix is already selling the veterinary version of that in the UK and the US. We also have an industrial application for non-destructive evaluation, NDE. We're already selling that product as well. And we're gearing up to sell the Adaptix orthopedic product in the US. That'll probably start early next year. There's some work going on, distribution channels, et cetera, there for that to make that happen effectively.
That's FDA approved, though, isn't it?
That's approved, yes. Yeah. So we're ready to go there, basically. So it's for Adaptix, they're a bit behind where we'd like them to be. That's mainly been about setting up the distribution channels and training them in the right way, etc. But they're off to the races. They started selling product, and as I say, the customer reaction is tremendous. So that's really encouraging. And on the Magnetica side, of course, they're currently just focused on orthopedics. So their first product for high field MRI, that's now at a point where and investors will see this on our website if they want to take a look. We've put a little link to an Adaptix presentation, but also some images from the Magnetica system. The Magnetica system is now producing MRI images, which are as good as a whole body system. So, but again, it's a small format. It's only for limbs. It's for arms and legs. It's not a full-scale system. But of course, by being much smaller, we can site it in places where you couldn't site a whole body system. And it's much cheaper because you don't have all the infrastructure cost of a whole body system. So the point about what we're doing in all cases here is not to compete with GE or Philips or whatever in hospitals, but exactly as you say, is to get care to the point of care, so orthopedic surgeries, walk-in ambulatory clinics, etc., and to have that lined up for when people walk in so that you can get an X-ray in 20 minutes, not wait for 6 hours for an X-ray. That's the game for us. And the point about that is, as I say, we're putting product where it doesn't currently go, or at least these types of products don't currently go, and we're putting it into places where people can get point of care in a much faster and more efficient way, and with products that cost less than the alternatives. So that's the game for us. And of course, we're very keen to avoid the big guys. There's no point in trying to compete with Siemens or Philips or GE or whatever. But by going at the slice of market that we're going at, which they're really not interested in, that takes us into a place where we think we can be really competitive and really effective.
Mm. And what's the sort of marketing strategy? Because obviously this is a new sort of area that is underserved, and there's high unmet demand for the whole sort of like small form MRI and X-ray. How you go about marketing, telling people who are those key decision makers and the opinion leaders about the product?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned key opinion leaders. That's a key thing for us to do, is to get some of them to take the product in the first place in the different markets. And that's what Adaptix are already on with doing. And Magnetica are courting people as well, but of course they haven't got the 510K yet, so they can't sell their MRI product yet in America. But we've certainly got the attention of key opinion leaders for all of these products, and some on the Adaptix side are already buying the product. So they're important because they're an important reference point for everybody else to consider buying the product. So that's one thing. The second thing, of course, is going to the appropriate trade shows to market the product and get the attention of the folks who are your target market. So we focus on, for example, the Adaptix team are going to a show shortly, which is focused just on hands. It's American Society of Hand Surgeons. And so they only scan hands. So that's very specialist, but that's the sort of target we're after rather than general medical exhibitions. And then also the third thing is the distribution strategy. So the route to market for us to go faster is through distribution. So we're not setting up our own sales team in America. We know that's very expensive and takes quite a long time. So we're just going to well-established distributors who know where the customers are, the appropriate customers, and who they can target those people effectively and quickly. We've already signed up the first distributor in America, both for Adaptix and Magnetica. And then we're also signed up with distributors in the UK. And subsequently, we'll do the same thing in Europe and elsewhere. But so far, we're really just focused on America and the UK to get them up and running as we gear up production also. But then we'll start focusing on Europe later as well.
Okay, so the Adaptix X-ray is approved in the UK and US, and
No,
the
it's not actually approved in the UK yet for orthopedics. The vet product's fine and the
yeah.
non-destructive evaluations product is fine, but we've still got to approve it officially for orthopedics in the UK. But that's pretty much a formality. It's just paperwork. And of course, we're doing the same for Europe with CE marking. So it's really about CE marking. Adaptix have got to get it next. But that's well underway and they'll get that
Yeah.
in the early part of next year, I think.
And the MRI is still awaiting orthopedics approval in the UK as well as in the
As well as
US.
the US, correct. So we can't sell the MRI product yet, except perhaps the research applications. But the key there is just to get the FDA approval of 510K. And we have to admit that's taken us a lot more effort than we thought, principally because the FDA have upped the ante dramatically in terms of cybersecurity and put all sorts of extra documentation and test requirements around cybersecurity. And that's cost us months and months of extra work to get to that point. But as I say, what we know now is, and investors will see from the images that, I mean, they're not radiologists, but they'll be able to tell from the quality of the images that we're really happy with the product now. The product works. We just got to get through this mountain of paperwork for the FDA to be able to officially sell the product in the US. It is what it is. Everybody's got the same problems, not just us. But it does take a lot of effort, and we've been quite shocked by the sheer level of effort Magnetica has got to go through. But it'll get there. It's just working through eating the elephant a bite at a time, and we'll eventually eat the whole elephant.
Yeah, well, it certainly does put up big barriers to entry for other people into that industry. Can you just talk through also what sort of like sort of considered options you have for sort of like realizing value? Because I know I think the chairman mentioned that there's some vehicles that they might be considered for the healthcare division.
Yeah, I'll let Steve pick up that one. But yeah, we're thinking about various exit options there. Probably focusing on IPO is the most likely version. But you know, we're not against any version of exit for the medical businesses in due course. Of course, they're not ready to be exited yet. They've
Yeah.
still got a way to go. But Steve, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll concur with that, Steve. The both those medical sides are mainly pre-revenue, and we've got to prove ourselves revenue generating first to get the maximum book. But at some stage, there's going to be need a further investment in working cap, etc. So I think that's what the chairman was leading to, that saying there's various ways of doing that, bringing in other investors who will be keen as soon as we get into the revenue generation. We've done all the heavy lifting. There could be a trade sale. We're not adverse to that if it's the right price. But also, we've always spoken about potentially an IPO for either them both together, or either one going to a separate IPO to unleash the opportunity there. Maybe keeping a lot of the shares for the Avintrans shareholders themselves, or giving the shares so they can share with the uplift later. So there's quite a few things to think about there, but the first challenge is getting revenue there. Well, sorry, the first challenge is getting the product working, which it seems to be doing, and then getting into revenue generation, cash generation, etc. And then, all these opportunities will come good, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, we've certainly got a busy next 12 to 18 months. And so just at the end then, sir, Steve, can you just talk through the sort of the outlook, the order book, and how you're
Okay.
seeing in terms of you guys are going to be really busy, aren't you?
I mean, order books one to probably start on, Paul. I mean, you'll see the forecasts that go out from the analysts, I'm sure. But I'm sure there'll be a strong uplift in this year, in particular in the AES division, as you've said. The order book cover on those forecasts will be similar to last year, about 90% for FY25 and 45% for the following year, so FY26, which we'll put into the city expectations as well. So it's the same as last year, but the number will be a lot bigger. All right. The orders and performance in the first quarter is strong, ahead of last year, significantly ahead of last year on some orders. And we've got some exciting orders that have come in. And the orders, type of orders we're looking at is what we've just talked about: new nuke, defense. We haven't even really spoken about China, but there's been a big uplift in China energy demand for AI and data centers, HS2, Sellafield, etc. etc. There's lots of exciting things that we are we're looking at. And of course, then we've got these long-term orders in there as well, as I spoke earlier about Sellafield and HS2. So, we still got to do it, but the first thing is getting those orders in the door, etc. And we're looking forward to some good progression in FY25.
Brilliant. Okay. And then any sort of final messages at all for shareholders, Stephen? Because you really have reached a bit of an inflection point here, haven't you? Because everything seems to be moving in the right direction and you've got lots of different options. But any sort of final thoughts?
I think folks can expect more of the same from us, Paul. We're pretty consistent in terms of how we approach this game and what we do with it. And more of the same. I think we're more focused now on the I part of pie, and we're moving on to the E part of pie, the exit part, for some of the businesses. The I part will continue, particularly for the medical side, and some new product investment as well, as Steve said earlier. And then exits, well, watch this space. But we'd be disappointed if this time next year, in September next year, we haven't exited at least one business for us to talk about in terms of where we got to with that.
Yeah, well, I would say as an external shareholder that with the shares at about £4.30, if you start going through some value sort of lucrative deals later, in the year, exits or whatever like that, realization, those catalysts, then you can see have a real big change in the shares quite quickly as people start realizing the value of the underlying businesses there. All
Hopefully
right.
so. Let's see.
Great. Well, thanks again, guys. Really well done, and look forward in touching base going forward. So thanks.
Thanks,
Thank you.
Paul.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.